Welcome back to The Daily Drum on WHUR, Sirius XM Channel 141, 96.3 HD2 and 98.3 FM. This is the Insight segment. I'm Harold Fisher. If you are pregnant or want to be, this is a Medical Monday conversation for you. Why has there been an increase in the number of cesarean section procedures in the delivery room? In a new report, the CDC says every 3 out of 5 women who have given birth by C-section have not had one before. This increase has been gradual over the past 25 years. Well, joining us to talk about this is Dr. Kerry Lewis, OBGYN and Medical Director for Women and Infant Services for the University of Maryland Medical System. If you have a comment, if you have a question about C-sections, particularly if you are pregnant or want to be, give us a call. Lines are open right now at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. You can tweet me at HFisher, WHUR, or find me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Dr. Lewis, thank you so much for joining the conversation.
Harold, it's a pleasure to be with you this evening. Absolutely a pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
Well, this is a really important conversation, not just for expectant mothers, but also certainly for families. Let's kind of start at the very beginning. Can you explain what a cesarean section is? What is the procedure for that?
Okay. I'd love to. Well, a cesarean section is a surgery. It's actually one of the most, it is the top surgical procedure done in this country. It is a surgery that is performed in order to bypass the normal delivery, vaginal delivery of a baby. So, you know, women are biologically designed to have babies born vaginally, and that's the normal route. However, I guess over the many, many years that has been noted that that has presents itself with some difficulty and some challenges, we basically bypass that way of delivery and actually do a surgery, and that is an abdominal surgery. So we make an incision. Usually that incision is made just at the lower part of the abdomen. It is a transverse incision. I like a lot of people refer to it as a bikini cut, right, because obviously it doesn't have the same scar that a vertical scar would have. And then you enter into the lower part of the abdominal cavity, i.e. into the pelvis, that then you then get access to the uterus, and then you actually make an incision into the uterus where the baby and the placenta and the amniotic fluid are all present. And then you basically deliver the baby through that incision. You deliver the baby and the placenta through that incision. And then, of course, you then close that incision back up. You close the uterus back up. You close the skin back up and all the other muscles and tissues associated with access to the uterus. So that's basically what a cesarean section is. That basically is what it is. And it's a very common surgery that's performed throughout the United States.
Under what circumstances would a physician decide that this is absolutely necessary?
Well, I appreciate you asking the question like that. The operative words are absolutely necessary. There are situations in which a cesarean section is absolutely necessary, not only for the health of the mother, but for the health of the baby, and frequently for both. Situations like a placenta previa. Placenta previa is a situation where the placenta is located on the cervix, and it basically obstructs the ability of the baby to deliver normally through the cervix and then through the vagina. You can imagine that the placenta being there in that location, if she were to labor, that there would be an enormous amount of bleeding that could be life-threatening to both mom and baby. So in that situation, a cesarean delivery is indicated and mandatory. Situations in which a patient has had multiple prior surgeries on her uterus, like having a myomectomy when she's had multiple fibroids and fibroids are removed, and that causes a scar in the uterus that during labor could rupture, and that would be obviously catastrophic for both mom and baby. So in those situations, a cesarean delivery would be absolutely necessary. And then in situations in which a patient is in labor, or maybe even not in labor, but presents in a situation where the baby is in distress, we put the baby on the monitor, and we identify that the tracing is what we call non-reassuring. We now use the terminology of category 3 to identify a situation in which we feel the baby is at risk for being hypoxic and thereby suffering significant brain and neurologic injury if allowed to continue in labor. And so in order to avoid that from happening, we would do a cesarean delivery. So those are three examples of situations in which a cesarean delivery would be mandatory.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. It's a Medical Monday conversation. We're talking about cesarean sections, C-sections. Why does there, according to a CDC report, appear to be an increase in the number of C-sections that are happening in the delivery room? Is this something that mothers should be concerned about? If you have a comment or a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. You mentioned three situations that were obviously medically necessary, the danger of the mother, the danger of the child. But I do know that there have been situations where those situations are not the case, where the baby isn't necessarily turning, where the child by with the mother in labor in the delivery room, where the baby's head is not pointed down toward the birth canal. The baby may be across, mm-hmm. or feet down, or in there eating Cheetos and watching TV, whatever babies do before. Is that another situation under which a C-section would be deemed medically necessary?
Yes. In general, yes. And let me qualify the answer to that particular question. I mean, my previous answer was situations in which it's clearly in the life, both the risk, the life of the mother and or the baby is at risk.
Mm-hmm.
In the situation of what you're referring to as a breech delivery, right? The situation in which the butt comes first and not the head. It used to be back in the day, even kind of early when I was trained and maybe even before, that physicians did vaginal breech deliveries. It was commonly done. There are certain maneuvers that you do when that occurs. And even now today, there are patients that present so far along in labor that you don't have time really to do a C-section. And so you end up delivering those babies vaginally. We choose not to recommend a vaginal delivery for a breech delivery, primarily because of the fact that we're concerned about an event called head entrapment. That is the situation is as the butt is coming through and the breast of the body is coming through, the head gets caught and the head can't get through. And this usually happens in premature babies, right, where the head gets caught. And when the head gets entrapped, you can imagine a situation where the cord is compressed, the baby's neck is compressed, the baby's basically strangling. And by the time you're able to get that baby delivered, it could suffer irreversible damage, including death. And so we avoid breech deliveries in general because of that risk. That risk is very small. It is a very small risk. Most patients that present in labor and when it's too late to do a C-section, they end up delivering vaginally, and there's really no concerns and no issues. But the risk associated with someone laboring with a baby that's breech is just such a significant risk when the solution is pretty straightforward doing a C-section. We choose to recommend that. But it is not as life-threatening in terms of the potential to have a vaginal delivery as the other circumstances that I've just described.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We're talking about cesarean section births. Why has there been an increase in the number of C-section births over the past 25 years, according to a CDC report? Let's go to T calling from D.C. Thanks for calling, T. What's on your mind?
Yes, hi. I just wanted to make a comment. My daughter just had an emergency C-section 3 days ago. My grandbaby's 3 days old. And I was kind of upset that she did not have one it wasn't scheduled previously. She had had throughout the pregnancy, she had been vomiting, had headaches. They said the baby was almost 10 pounds, so she was high risk, but glucose, was all normal. So It wasn't that there was gestational diabetes, but she had been in labor or having, well, not in labor, but having Braxton Hicks. Her pelvis was almost, you might as well say, paralyzed from all of the contractions she was having. And they kept putting it off. They kept saying first that they were going to try to make her have it vaginally. Then they told her if the baby reaches 10 pounds, they were going to make her, they were going to schedule her for a C-section. They were going to induce her or do a balloon and a membrane sweep. Those were the three things that they were going to do first. Then they said they were going to do a C-section. So anyway, I get her to the hospital on Friday, on actually Thursday. She's contracting. Contractions are 5 minutes apart. They're lasting 45 seconds long. They send her home, tell her to come back. We come back at 7. They say they're going to induce her, but when she gets there, she's only...
So, I appreciate your passion in this story, but my show is only an hour. I need to get to two issues. The first issue is, how is the baby?
The baby's fine.
Okay, how is your daughter now?
She is in a lot of pain, of course. She went through almost 24 hours worth of labor, and the baby's heart rate and, you know, everything went down several times, you know, and they did everything, induction, oxytocin, epidural, all of that stuff.
So you're saying that she didn't have a C-section?
She did have a C-section.
She did. What is your concern?
My concern was this. I just felt that she was in so much pain, and the doctors were trying to, you know, to take her out of this distress, and the stress that they put on the baby and my daughter, you know, I felt just put the child and my daughter at risk.
Okay.
Without going ahead and doing the C-section.
So let me see what Dr. Lewis has to say about what he's hearing. Dr. Lewis?
Yeah, and I'm glad to hear that both mom and baby are doing very well, because you could have told us a different story given the circumstance around her labor. I will say this, being objective about the story that you just said, I do commend the team that he appears to have taken care of your daughter, because a lot of physicians will just do a C-section, just go right off and do a C-section, not taking into consideration the post-operative recovery, not taking into consideration the desires of the mother, the desires of the family. I anticipate that it was hoped, particularly since that she didn't have diabetes and no other reasons to schedule her for a C-section, that she would have a normal vaginal delivery and not have the complications or the discomfort associated with a C-section. So I think one of the things you're referencing is that we have learned that in the presence of reassuring fetal tracing, and we all have this monitoring that we do throughout the labor, that we really try and allow for patients to have a vaginal delivery. Most physicians, most providers don't want to do a C-section, particularly unnecessarily. So as long as the tracing remains reassuring, as long as everything is progressing, and sometimes it takes longer than other times. So 24 hours sounds like a lot, but having seen a lot of deliveries in my career, there are a lot of patients who deliver normally, vaginally, and have labor for 24, 36, even 48 hours. And we allow that longevity in the process as long as we know that mom and baby are okay. In your situation, the only thing that I would have some pause to is the fact that you described that there were some decelerations or changes in the fetal heart rate, right? And so to that extent, we know that a lot of times during labor that there are changes in the fetal heart rate that may generate some concern, but usually they resolve and we allow the labor to progress. But once we identify that the tracing is not improving, that the tracing is actually deteriorating, and it appears that the baby is not going to tolerate labor, then it's appropriate to intervene. And sometimes, you know, depending upon your impression of the tracing, some people intervene earlier than other people. But I think the idea to be able to identify a tracing that needs immediate intervention, i.e. that needs a cesarean delivery, and at the same time allowing the patient to have the experience of a normal vaginal delivery, you got to kind of, you know, balance those two issues, always with the goal of both mom and baby being delivered well.
T, is this your daughter's first child?
Yes, and to me, I just...
Okay, hold on. How old is she?
That's what I was going to tell you. She's 23.
She's 23. So here's my question, Dr. Lewis, before the break. Based on what T is telling us, because it does sound very, very much, you know, like, I mean, certainly, you know, childbirth is an ordeal no matter what, as we know. But she sounds like she went through a whole lot. What would you expect her recovery to be like, and how long?
Well, usually I tell my patients anywhere from 6 to 8 weeks before they fully recover. Sometimes mm-hmm. it takes as long as 12 weeks. It kind of depends upon there's any extenuating circumstances. For example, hypertension or diabetes. It sounds like that T's daughter did not have those complications. But in those situations, the recovery can be much longer. We also know that cesarean deliveries that are performed under emergency situations, which it sounds like may have happened here, also at increased risk for increased blood loss, thereby being anemic, thereby being tired and fatigued and requiring sometimes blood transfusions or iron therapy, also increased risk for infection. So we really try to avoid those complications that can definitely be manifested in the postoperative recovery period.
T, thank you so much for calling. I'm glad to hear that the baby is fine. I'm glad to hear that your daughter is fine under the circumstances. And congratulations to you, Grandma. Yeah. You hear that giggle? Yeah, that's a grandmother's giggle. T, thank you so very, very much. I appreciate your phone call. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. It's a Medical Monday conversation. We are talking about cesarean sections. If you have a comment, if you have a question, give us a call. Going to take a quick break, but don't forget you can hear this in every Daily Drum Insight segment conversation via podcast. It's on our website on WHUR.com after 8:30. And don't forget to download the 96.3 HD2 app on your smartphone and hear the program live in its entirety. If you're on the phone, stay with us. You'll hear the program and I'll take your phone calls next. Kim, Danielle, Jamie, do not hang up. I'm Harold Fisher. John Mons is next with the original Quiet Storm. That's on WHUR. This conversation continues on SiriusXM in just a few seconds. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on SiriusXM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Tonight we're talking about C-sections, cesarean sections. The CDC has issued a new report saying that there has been an increase over the past quarter century in C-sections in the delivery room. Why is that, and should mothers be concerned? My guest is Dr. Kerry Lewis, OBGYN and Medical Director for Women and Infant Services at the University of Maryland Medical System. If you have a comment or a question, give us a call. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Let's talk to Kim calling from Laurel. Kim, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hey, thank you, Harold, for taking my question.
Sure.
Dr. Lewis, I wanted to ask you, is it recommended based on the amount of fibroids that you see in especially African-American women, do you recommend that they get those taken care of before they become pregnant or before they give birth to prevent cesareans?
Yeah, that is a very frequent question, and thank you for that question. And just for clarification, I'm at the University of Maryland Capital Region Health.
Okay, thank you.
System, but the Capital mm-hmm. Region Health here in Largo. So we know that fibroids can very, very frequently complicate a pregnancy. It complicates it in usually one of two ways. Either one, they cause a lot of pain. You know, women have fibroids, and a lot of times when they're not pregnant, they know they occasionally have pain, usually during the menstrual cycle. And then, but then when they get pregnant, that pain could be even worse. It's called degenerating fibroids. This is when the blood flow that normally would support the fibroid is actually diverted to the fetus and the placenta, and thereby the fibroid doesn't get adequate blood supply and becomes very painful, and the mother experiences that. So frequently it's very challenging to deal with the pain of degenerating fibroids during pregnancy. The other thing that fibroids cause during pregnancy is obstruction, right? Are the fibroids in the way of a normal vaginal delivery? Sometimes we have women that have fibroids that are so large and right down in what we call the lower uterine segment that it actually obstructs the ability to have a normal vaginal delivery. And in those cases, we actually have to do a C-section only because there's no way of getting the baby delivered normally. And that creates its own set of complications, because one thing that we try never to do is at time of, if we have to do a C-section on someone with fibroids, is to try and avoid removing the fibroids at that time. Because trying to remove the result of removing a fibroid during a C-section makes it very difficult to reapproximate or to really bring back the edges of the uterus, because you've had that big fibroid there. You can imagine now you have this big cavity in the uterus, and you try and bring that back together. That becomes extremely complicated and sometimes results in a hysterectomy, because we can't stop the bleeding and can't adequately reapproximate the uterus. So there are definitely things to be concerned about when you're pregnant with fibroids, depending upon the number of fibroids and how, what size they are and where they're located. As it relates to whether or not they should be removed or treated prior to pregnancy, I usually kind of lead that and lend that to the GYN specialist, who can better identify the geography of the fibroids and where they're located and how they could potentially interfere with the pregnancy. There are some arguments that they should be left alone, because once you remove a fibroid, you actually damage the uterus such that it may make it risky to, first of all, to become pregnant. Then when you do become pregnant, the risk for uterine rupture, as I mentioned before, becomes very significant. So again, it kind of depends on what your doctor thinks, but I do think there are certain situations which the fibroid should be removed before you get pregnant. But I would say in most situations, they do not need to be removed before you become pregnant.
Okay. Kim, thank you so much for your phone call. Before I go back to the phone lines, I did have a question. You're obviously familiar with the CDC report, Dr. Mm-hmm. Lewis. Your thoughts about why there are so many more cesarean sections now as opposed to vaginal birth?
Okay. So that is the crux of the environment we live in now. And there are reasons. And I'll go through them as quickly and as concisely as possible, because there are a number of them.
Go ahead.
One of them is just the acuity of the patients that we see today. It is so often, I'm sure any obstetrician, gynecologist who takes care of pregnant women are surprised by the number of women who present with high-risk issues, like particularly hypertension and preeclampsia, diabetes. All of these high-risk factors tend to affect the baby, and they end up causing what we call fetal growth restriction, intrauterine growth restriction. These are diseases or disorders that occur as a result of a unhealthy placenta, as a result of the mother's hypertension and diabetes, that then is compromised in its ability to really support the developing fetus, resulting in fetal growth restriction, such that when the patient presents in labor, she has these abnormal fetal tracings that require intervention, because it basically shows that the baby cannot tolerate labor contractions. When a woman contracts, there is no blood supply to the fetus. It's cut off. So for a baby that's healthy, it can handle 60 seconds or even 2 minutes of no blood supply, no oxygen, because it's healthy. But take a baby that's growth restricted in the presence of a mother who has these other comorbidities, that baby can't tolerate it. And so as a result of that, they end up having a C-section. The second reason, is around education, how we're educated as obstetricians. So, as I mentioned before about doing the breech deliveries, we're not trained to do breech deliveries anymore. Matter of fact, nobody does breech deliveries anymore. So to that extent, you don't have physicians adequately trained to do breech deliveries, let alone during what we call external cephalic versions. An external cephalic version is a process by which we actually turn the baby, right? And most of the time, 80% of the time, that can be successful in converting a baby from breech to cephalic or head down, and thereby supporting a vaginal delivery. Not many physicians coming out of training are trained to do that procedure. The other thing that results in C-sections is patients about to deliver. They're in the second stage of labor. The head is coming down. The tracing looks bad. And you can't get the baby out because you don't know how to do a vacuum or forceps delivery. We're not trained to do those as well as we were years ago. And so as a result of that, the only thing that they're trained to do is do a C-section. In addition to that, it used to be that patients were offered, if they wanted to have a C-section, we say, okay, whatever the patient wants is whatever they request. Fortunately, there was a lot of pushback from the medical community on that. And so many women, it's very few women that actually would prefer or choose to have a C-section instead of trying for a vaginal delivery. Very few women try that. And then finally, what I would say is that a lot of institutions don't have the support of nurse midwives. Nurse midwives are extremely talented, at avoiding doing C-sections. I mean, we're fortunate at our institution and other institutions. I even think Howard has midwives that help to create a situation, an environment where they're much more attuned to the needs of the patient as a woman and as a pregnant woman in labor. And they are very talented in their maneuvers that they can do to have babies delivered vaginally. I know situations in our own midwives where we have patients, it looks like the baby's not going to deliver, and we're ready to do a C-section. All of a sudden, they do some maneuver or something that they do, and all of a sudden, the baby comes out. So that doesn't happen all the time, and it may not even happen most of the time. But it is a resource that we have available to us that reduces that C-section rate. So there's just a number of reasons. And the last thing that also, one other thing that I'll say, also the size of the baby. I think T was talking about the baby being 10 pounds.
Right.
So our ultrasounds are used to estimate fetal weight, and they're not that accurate. They're pretty good, but not that accurate. But we know from our training that any baby that is estimated weight of 5,000 grams or more, or 4,500 grams or more if they're diabetic, that babies of that size, the mother should be offered a C-section because the risk of shoulder dystocia, the risk of emergency C-sections all become greater when the babies are excessively large. So all of these things contribute to the increase in primary C-section rate, which is why we work so hard these days, and currently in the last few years, to try and reduce that primary C-section rate.
Back to the phone lines, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Danielle calling from Upper Marlboro. Danielle, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Sure. Hi, Harold. Hi, Dr. Lewis.
Hi,
Danielle. Hey. Hi. You just hit on so many passion items for me. I've had two C-sections. And I actually wanted a C-section, and I was told no by my doctor because it's obviously a major surgery. I had no desire to do a vaginal birth. And in the end, my first baby ended up in distress. And my doctor told me, you know, if we needed to go down the route of the C-section, she would tell me. And ultimately, I ended up getting my wish because I ended up having one. And then my second baby ended up being a scheduled C-section since I've had one at first. So I just want to say that, you know, with the question about an increase in C-sections, I'm grateful that we have that option to be able to save lives and save our babies' lives from all of the different situations that Dr. Lewis just talked about. And if we didn't have that, I just feel like there would be so many more instances of losses of our babies and even of our mothers. So, and the more and more we learn about data and about birth, if it's to have a C-section because it's the safe thing for the mother and for the baby, I say why question it?
Mm-hmm. Dr. Lewis,
but I think I appreciate your determination to have to be treated the way you want to be treated, because I think that's one of the things that's extremely important, right? We need to be more available to communicate with our patients, to understand what our patients' needs are, and to be able to respond to their needs in a way that is most conducive to their well-being and the well-being of their family. I think counseling is very important in the scenario that you just presented, because most doctors would tell you that the risks associated with C-section are much greater than the risks associated with vaginal delivery. Clearly, there's an increased risk of bleeding. There's an increased risk of pulmonary embolism. There's an increased risk of infection. There's an increased risk of pain, and the recovery period is prolonged, which obviously can affect not only the patients, just their recovery, but also their ability to go back to work, et cetera, et cetera. I think that once a patient is given that information, and if she still decides that that's what she would like to do, then she should be given that opportunity, as long as we understand that the risks are definitely there. Now, I would extend that conversation and say there are a lot of physicians, like in general, that our responsibility is to make sure that you get the care that you need and the care that you would prefer. And so in a situation where the provider may not be prepared to give you that C-section upon request, that's what's called C-section on request, then they should be able to refer you to somebody who would, right? There is the philosophy around the risks associated with doing a primary C-section, and does the physician have to take that risk in a situation that's basically elective? And so for some physicians, they would choose not to take that risk, but at the same time, being respectful to your wishes, refer you to someone who would be willing to fulfill your desires, and there are physicians who would definitely do that.
Danielle, I wasn't clear. You said you had two children. You've had one C-section or two?
I had two.
You had two. Are you planning on having more children?
Oh, no. The bank is closed forever. No, sir. My cup is full.
Are you coming? Okay. Well, okay.
My cup is full. And I just want to say, I'm you know, Dr. Lewis, what you were saying about being counseled by your doctor, I had such faith and trust in my OBGYN. She's been caring for me from the start and for my babies. And she did. We had an honest conversation when she knew what my wishes were, right? And it's not that she was, you know, telling me no, but it was just, it's just like you were saying, right? It's to consider all of the risks and make the right decision for me. And ultimately, again, I ended up with a C-section because it was absolutely necessary for the health of my baby. And I had been through a lot, 28 hours of labor.
Ooh.
So we made the call and it was time. And I joked with her and I said, I told you I wanted a C-section. So I ended up getting it. I got my wish.
Oh.
And it was great.
Good.
I can imagine it may not have exactly sounded quite like that, but Danielle, thank you so much. I appreciate
You're welcome.
I appreciate
you.
Your phone call. Dr. Lewis, to Danielle's point, when should the option of a C-section be presented to the expectant mother?
So it's really based on, as far as the discussion in the prenatal period, it's really based upon what the clinical findings are that increase the risk of the patient having to need a cesarean delivery. So we talked about the size of the baby. We talked about not only the big baby, but also the small babies, the growth-restricted babies, because those are the babies that, like I mentioned earlier, are the ones that really don't tolerate the contractions so well, and so therefore end up having a C-section because of the size of the baby. The other issue is the health of the mother, right? Some women present with these enormously elevated blood pressures, 210 over 120. I've seen patients with frequent patients, 200 over hundreds, right? And they're coming in with headaches. Most doctors are not going to try and get their blood pressure under control, then they're going to deliver them. Because it's hard to try and control the blood pressures and at the same time try to support this patient during her labor process. So a lot of these deliveries will occur because of the mother's condition. Not so much that the baby can't tolerate labor, but the mother's condition is so of such deep concern that if she's allowed to stay pregnant much longer, there's concern that that both mom and baby will succumb to that environment. So in those situations, the recommendation would just be to go ahead and do a C-section. But these are acute events. They're not things that necessarily have been followed throughout the pregnancy, right? These are things that just happen at 36 weeks. She comes in, her blood pressure is high, right? Or her diabetes is out of control, or the fetal tracing is really bad, or there's no fluid around the baby. These things happen acutely. So it's hard to really, except for those situations where prior C-section, they have a placenta preview, or those things that we know are going to end up in a C-section, it's hard to predict. However, when we counsel patients during their prenatal care, we try and give them some idea of under what circumstance would we recommend during a C-section, especially during for our first pregnancy. What are the situations that would result in recommending doing a cesarean delivery? And that's the kind of conversation we have. And some patients, again, you can predict it or a high risk of it based upon certain parameters, but a lot of them you can't.
It seems to me, based on this conversation that we're having right now, and people like Danielle, for example, like she said, I told you I wanted a C-section. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It just seems to me that mothers are now saying they want it, which I'm not, in looking kind of at the CDC, report. I'm just going to say it just seems that the reason that this is happening is because mothers want. I mean, yeah, you may have medical necessities. Understood. Mm-hmm. I get that. But then you have the Danielles, for example, mm-hmm. or T, the grandmother talking about her granddaughter, who's like, hey, look, let's do this, as opposed to just something that the OBGYN says. Right. Should be an option.
Well, when you look at the data, when you hear those conversations like we just had with Danielle, you would think that that happens more often than not. But in reality, it's only about 3%. 3 to 5% of primary C-sections are the result of someone requesting them. So the vast majority of them are not patient requests. That number has increased very, very slightly over the years. As a matter of fact, not even in a significant way to start to promote that. When that idea first came out around 10 years ago, where there were studies that were done more about doing C-sections on upon request, it was thought that, oh, we're going to have all these patients that are going to want C-sections. And we did not see that influx. Yeah, we definitely saw some. But the vast majority of these primary C-sections are not by maternal request.
We've got another call coming in. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Terry? Terry?
Yes.
You're on, calling from D.C.
Yeah. Harold, we appreciate all you do, man. You're hardworking. Thank you.
Thank you.
Greetings, Dr. Lewis. I wanted to address the fact that, one, when the mother has a vaginal birth, then the baby, the newborn, is sanctioned with good bacteria from the vagina and her body onto the baby. And it's said that from a natural health perspective, I do natural health, that when the baby is not able to get that sanctioning through the vaginal birth, yes.
Terry, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, you know what? That's a very interesting perspective, and I do appreciate that because that is true. There is some data that has shown not only that there's some benefit to the baby delivering through the vaginal canal as a result of exposure to the bacteria, but also the fact that contractions help to remove a lot of the fluid in the lungs. And so the baby's transition into an oxygen environment where it's depending upon its own lungs for ventilation, that there's a significant benefit by having gone through labor. So yes, there are some value in going through labor other than just, you know, the healing and the decreased blood loss and the decreased risk of infection, the medical parameters that we always look at. There are these other benefits that have been shown. Right. And so to that extent, the fact that it's just like when you have children exposed to certain viruses, if they're exposed to the viruses when they're little, then they develop the antibodies and they develop the protective mechanisms to be able to address those bacteria or those viruses when they see them again later in life. Very similar parameters around the newborn and as it relates to a vaginal delivery. So, yes, that is something to be taken into consideration as when you list all of the benefits of a normal vaginal delivery.
Okay. Terry, thank you so much for your phone call. Here's my other question in reference to just this process. How many, and I'm sure it varies from patient to patient, but how many C-sections is too many?
Ooh, I like that question. Thank you so much for asking me that question. I might have forgotten to mention it. Studies have shown that 5 or more C-sections are associated with a significant increased risk of adverse outcome, including maternal death. And the reason this is the following. Patients who've had multiple surgeries on their uterus develop scar tissue. And the scar tissue promotes a development of something that we call a placenta accreta, or a placenta inserting into the uterine, into the mom region, inserts into the wall of the uterus, such that once the patient delivers, normally the baby delivers and the placenta comes out right afterwards. In this situation, the placenta does not come out and cannot come out because it's basically embedded in the uterine wall. And so as a result of that, the patient ends up having a hysterectomy in order to stop the bleeding since the placenta cannot be removed. And in that situation, obviously you can imagine the amount of blood loss in that situation, the fact that there's a potential that you can mess with the urinary system during the surgical procedure. There are some such significant risks associated with that that we strongly encourage or at least counsel women regarding the significant increase in risk associated with 5 or more C-sections. In addition to the risk for the placenta accreta, there's also risk for bowel injury, bladder injury, risk for significant blood loss, as I just mentioned, increased risk of infection because the scar tissue becomes so enormous in those situations that the risk to the other structures in the abdominal cavity become at significant risk. So, but it's at around about five C-sections that that becomes a major concern.
But even at, you know, more than two, I know that there are some women who have complained about this, for lack of a better term, this thing called this muffin top kind of look. What causes that? And is there some way that that can be avoided, short of delivering the child and then, of course, later having the mommy makeover and all of that?
So, you know, just being realistic and being honest, I'm not aware of any procedures or any interventions other than what you just mentioned, kind of the surgery, bowel surgery or surgeries, what we call gastroplasty and other surgeries that deal with that, that can really address that particular issue. Because the bottom line is that most of the damage that occurs or the risk that occurs or the scar that occurs always is internal. And that also leads to, as I also mentioned earlier, uterine rupture, right? And that doesn't, you don't even require five C-sections for that. You can have a uterine rupture with just one prior C-section, right? And so, and basically what happens is that along that scar, the uterus separates when the patient starts contracting, and it causes expulsion of the baby into the abdominal cavity and also the placenta, which can result in fetal death. So so those are all issues as it relates to the number of C-sections. Now, as far as the cosmetic or the appearance, there obviously are surgeries, liposuction surgeries. Those surgeries can be, and there are plastic surgeons that actually focus on redefining or reestablishing the appropriate or the anatomy that the woman would prefer to have in relationship to having completed childbearing. Of course, I wouldn't recommend that unless she has completed childbearing, because of course she gets pregnant again, then she may have some other results that she's not comfortable with. So once she's completed childbearing, then definitely that could be a surgery that can occur. But there's really no surgical procedure during the surgery itself that can reduce those potential complications as it relates to appearance.
Okay, let's go back to the phone lines. Christine calling from D.C. Christine, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, I am a patient, a former patient of Dr. Carrie Lewis, although I was under the care of another doctor. I delivered a baby girl in 2003, and Dr. Lewis delivered. I was a very high-risk pregnancy at the time, due to hypertension and obesity. And I'm very concerned on the day of delivery, but Dr. Lewis was very reassuring, and I delivered a healthy baby girl. She was the third child after a C-section. And so we weren't sure what we were facing that day. It was an induction of labor, and they watched me very carefully. I delivered vaginally that child after, you know, having had a C-section. And, you know, like I said, it's really important for the team that you have. And my doctor brought Dr. Lewis in for my delivery, and I'm very appreciative that young lady graduated this year from high school.
I was about to ask, how's she doing?
She's a beautiful, talented, creative young lady. She keeps me on my toes.
Okay,
yes,
so
she graduated
Christine.
This year. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks for calling. And Christine does bring up a very, something we haven't spent too much time talking about, is the VBAC, right? It's a vaginal birth after C-section, right? We really try as much as possible to allow for women to have that experience, because in spite of the fact that some women would prefer to have a C-section, there are a lot of women who, in spite of having had a C-section, really would like the experience of having had a vaginal delivery. And so to that extent, it's great that we can offer that. As Christine mentioned, you have to have the right support staff around you, and including anesthesia, nursing team, operating room, et cetera, because at any time she could experience a uterine rupture, which can require an emergent intervention. And as long as you prepare for it, usually both mom and baby will be fine, but you have to have the resources in place to do that. But that process, having a vaginal birth after C-section, is so, I have found so many women who have chosen that to be so appreciative of that opportunity, Not only Christine, and I appreciate Christine and her experience, and I appreciate and thank you for letting me take care of you. But that is an experience that a lot of institutions don't have the resources to support. So that's a good question to ask your doctor in the hospital where you plan on delivering. Can you VBAC? I had a C-section my last pregnancy. Do you allow for me to have a vaginal delivery this pregnancy? Because some hospitals don't have anesthesia in-house 24 hours, 7 days a week. They don't have obstetricians in-house 24 hours, 7 days a week. So those are very critical questions to ask in the event that you would like to have a vaginal delivery after having a prior C-section. And just to close on that point, our college, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, have documented that they would say that if you've had two or less prior C-sections, in other words, you have one or two prior C-sections, you would be a candidate for vaginal delivery. Most doctors don't offer that after the first C-section. They'll offer it after the first C-section, but not after the second one, because after the second C-section, even though it's not a significant increased risk, if you look at the evidence-based medicine profile, but there are usually anecdotal situations that doctors have experienced these uterine ruptures after two C-sections that make them very leery to do it again unless the patient is adequately counseled on the risk. But in general, if you have one prior C-section, a VBAC would definitely, depending upon the reasons for the first C-section, could be very much an opportunity for you to have.
Christine, what's the plan now for your daughter?
My daughter is waiting to enter the fire and EMS again. She wanted to be a nurse, but she can't do another. She said, I can't do another year of school, so she's going to do Fire and EMS Academy for the time being and then transition to nursing.
Sounds good to me. Two places where we need more heroes.
Absolutely.
Congratulations. Thank you, Christine. Tell her we said congratulations as well for graduating from high school. Thank you
okay,
so much.
Well.
And I want to thank you also, Dr. Kerry Lewis, for sharing your expertise with us. And gosh, this was a lot of information out there. Hopefully we were able to help mothers or those women who want to be mothers get through this really important process. So again, Dr. Lewis, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, Harold. Appreciate it.
That is the Daily Drum for this Monday, August 1st. I'm Harold Fisher. Good night.